game challenge begins. Launch. Circular orbit. Rapid rendezvous. Intercept and dock with International Space Station.
All engine running. Lift off. Tower clear.
Push the ISS to higher orbit. Rescue EVA astronauts. Avoid space debris. Destroy debris with missiles. Protect the ISS. For as long as possible. Deorbit. Land. Survive.
All in a day's work.
We had a pretty large bank.
We've had a problem here.
Post control, both autos. He's in engine command override off.
We've had shutdown.
Leo. Low Earth Orbit. A game from SkyrocketCafe.com.
This is XTP Media.
Hi, this is Diego López Salazar from Aeropodcast, and you're listening to Extended.
Welcome to the latest episode of Extended. Here are your hosts, Peter Johnson from XTP Media, Gareth Stringer from Global Aviation Resource, and Tim Robinson from the Royal Aeronautical Society.
Hello there, I'm Peter Johnson, and welcome to episode 18 of Extended. And joining me today are my co-presenters, Editor-in-Chief of Aerospace Magazine, Tim Robinson.
Hello there.
And also joining us, Editor of Global Aviation Resource, Gareth Stringer.
Episode 18. Wow. Hello.
Yes.
18, really?
They're loading up. They're loading up.
We can drink, go to the pub and everything.
And all on the support of Skyrocket Cafe. So they are supporting this program. Please do go to their website and support them. And in the show today, we talked to Tracy Curtis Taylor about her planned trip in a Stearman all the way from South Africa to the UK. And along with our usual segments, listener feedback and questions as well. But as always, let's get started by looking at what's in aerospace news. Okay, the first news story comes from Flight Global. Starts off with the VC-10 retirement, but there's been plenty enough said about that. As a result of that, we're now looking at the loss of the C-130Ks as well, by the end of this month, October, as we're recording. So with the loss of the C-130Ks and the VC-10s retiring, and before we see the A-400s coming into service, we're probably going to see the TriStars going out as well, Gareth.
That's right. Yeah, new platforms coming in normally means it is as a result of a platform retiring, or a platform retires as a result. And whilst we've obviously got the C-130Js, the venerable C-130Ks will be leaving us, and then next year the TriStar, another sort of an iconic airliner, really, I suppose, on the back of the VC-10 going. And these aircraft have been in service since just after the Falklands, if I remember correctly. I think 9 airframes. I think we got some from Summer XBA, Summer X Pan Am, possibly off the top of my head. And tanker and transport capability, but that's something that will be or is being picked up by the A330, the Voyager,
yeah,
which is now in service. And believe it or not, on the day that we're recording, a friend of mine is on the first Voyager trip down to the Falklands, so it's clearly an aircraft which is getting rapidly integrated into service. Yeah, but we get something new and something goes. But that's the way it is, I'm afraid.
Yeah, and I don't know if anyone else is still operating the TriStars, are they? Are these the last? I mean, obviously the VC-10s were the last operational ones worldwide, but I wonder if there's TriStars still operating.
That is a very, very good question. You've put me completely and utterly on
that's
the spot.
Right.
Because I don't know the answer off the top of my head. However, Tim Robinson might.
I think there might be a few sort of freighters still kind of knocking around.
I think it's limited service. I think we're talking probably the sort of handful of airframes, probably.
Yeah, very sad, very sad. And Tim, Michael O'Leary's been in the news, Ryanair. He's apparently going to try and be nice to customers, although I think in a recent UK survey, Ryanair came 100th out of 100 companies on customer service levels.
Yeah, I mean, this is interesting that obviously Ryanair is famous or infamous, should I say, for its kind of, let's say, interesting customer service culture. It hasn't got one. And at a recent sort of shareholder meeting, O'Leary said he's going to take steps to end their abrupt culture they have with customers. Now, this wasn't sort of conversion on the road to Damascus. This was basically some of his shareholders were complaining, saying, is this going to sort of damage the brand? So I think they're looking at sort of changing things. They've actually opened a Twitter account. Would you believe it? Which is quite interesting, given how that might kind of go wrong if they have complaints. But also it's symptom of a wider trend in that we've already seen EasyJet kind of go up market. EasyJet are sort of targeting business sort of customers.
Yeah, that's right.
They opened a route to Moscow earlier this year, and that's business traffic. So I think also that's Ryanair thinking right, okay, you maybe it's a sign of how many routes they've got over Europe, and they've got to try and sort of boost them by saturation of routes in Europe, and they've got to actually try and work harder to keep the existing customers or to kind of get new ones, not just based on constant expansion. Getting repeat customers.
Yeah, and they've had some really bad press recently. We saw over in the UK the Channel 4 programme about the pilots being uncomfortable with the pressure on efficiencies and fuel. But O'Leary does always think out the box, and I know there's a lot of people who don't care for his style, I think is the nicest way of putting it. But I think 2 or 3 weeks ago, in true Freddie Laker fashion, he announced that he expects to be flying transatlantic in 4 years' time for $10. Apparently can't do it now because all the long-haul aircraft orders are blocked out by Middle East Airlines in the manufacturing slots. So he's thought through his argument as to why he can't do it. I wonder if he actually can, though, or is he just pulling another O'Leary stunt?
That's an interesting one. I mean, it depends. He's probably thinking out there he can make the price of the ticket up by ancillaries. So, the idea is that the ticket will be the cheapest part of the flight, but once you pay for the pillows, once you pay for the pay for the meals, once you pay for the scratch card, once you pay for the car hire at the other end, the hotel, all these things, you kind of pile on, you might be able to get it. I don't know. That's an interesting one. I mean, he's obviously talking there about the A380. So let's see, A380, 555 passengers at the moment, but if he was to go to economy class, maybe up to 800. If there was a stretched A380, you could well, maybe you could pack them in. Maybe you could get 1,000 people. I don't know. Maybe in economy class.
Wow.
I don't know. This is just, you'd have to get someone who really knew the numbers here, and play with them and see what would you know. I mean, people have thought about this before. You know, low cost, long haul, and it's really the turnaround times at the other end. You know, can you fly it enough to make it work that way? Not really, because you've got the aircraft have a longer sort of turnaround time than the sort of, you know, 25 minutes quick you know, sort of clean and then back sort of straight away on the short haul. Interesting though.
Yeah, interesting to see if they can turn that image around. Certainly very, very negatively perceived over here in the UK. Let's look at our next story, which comes from defencenews.com, and it's the announcement that Affinity are to be awarded the fixed wing flying training contract as part of the MFTS program in the UK. A few surprises in there, Gareth.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, this has been 100%, you know, officially confirmed yet, but, you know, this is one that's been a long, long time coming, really. You know, what is the next stage? You know, Hawk T2 we've talked a little bit about on Extended before now, but then if you look at the rest of the fixed wing training with the tutor, you know, the Tucano is really the weak link at the moment, not necessarily in terms of the airframe, but in terms of the avionics and such like. And then, you know, we've got the King Air being used for multi-engine training. And the platforms are interesting. The Grob, the G120TP, which would replace the Tutor, I don't think is a big surprise, because I understand that both of the parties that were potentially bidding for this were recommending that as the platform.
Yeah.
The others raised a little bit of an eyebrow with me anyway. It's the T6, the Beechcraft T6C, as the basic turboprop trainer. So the new Tucano, if you like, although as Tim brilliantly reminded me just before we came on air tonight, that was kind of the aircraft the Air Force wanted back when we got the Tucano.
It's the PC-9, you know, basically sort of, I hesitate to say tarted up, but Americanized PC-9, you know. The Pilatus was one that kind of locked out against the Tucano in the first place.
Yeah, be careful what you wish for, because, you know, 30 years down the line or whatever, you might end up getting it. And the Embraer, the Phenom, the light business jet for multi-engine training, which is absolutely fascinating. But when you look at the multi-engine platforms that the Royal Air Force will be utilizing, things like Voyager and A400 and C-17, etc., you know, big digital aircraft and such like, you know, actually it kind of makes sense. And actually the other thing that interested me were the timescales, because this article is suggesting that things could get underway from about 2017 onwards, which is, you know, it's a few years away, but that's pretty quick. But this has been a long time coming, so they need to get a move on.
The only thing I'd say with that, Gareth, also is that the whole MFTS training system, you know, sort of service provision, was done in a time when we had a lot more frontline types.
Absolutely.
And a lot more pilots going through. So, you know, there is a sort of a question there of, you know, how much spare capacity is in the system. Will they have to get more kind of foreign pilots through, or you know, go out and kind of really market the service more to kind of foreign countries in order to make it viable, you know.
I think it's a good point there, Tim, as well, isn't there, Leah? Let's not forget that this is a partnership between, you know, industry and the military as well. So we're very much looking at, you know, contracts being in place that stipulate how many hours, how many people. And that's why, you know, the flip side of that, I guess, is that you have got a package, a system that you can then go out and sell to other countries if the capacity is there. So it's interesting.
And you mentioned the A400 briefly there, Gareth. France has got the first delivery of their A400M, and I believe we're due to get ours next year. We're going to finally see the Grizzlies.
You say finally. Again, it's another one that feels like it's been a long time coming. Obviously, they did have some power plant issues, if my memory serves me correctly, which I think was probably the biggest hold up maybe on the program. I think that the thing about the A400 is that when I talk to anybody who is in the Royal Air Force and operates in that part of the Royal Air Force, everybody says to me, wow, this is going to be an incredibly capable piece of equipment for the Royal Air Force, and it's going to be an absolutely fantastic aircraft. So yeah, so it's not going to be for about another 12 months or so, I think, but yeah, let's hope it should be worth waiting for.
Wow. There's also going to be Turkey is the next country to get their A400Ms.
Tim, seen a lot of social media traffic about upset recovery. Gotta say, I didn't quite get it, but you've been listening to some interesting information.
That's right. That comes out of our international flight crew training conference we had at the Aeronautical Society recently. Very, very interesting conference. Comes out of a lot of work that's being done by the society, by other sort of bodies, other stakeholders. And it's really recognizing in the past 15 years, there has been a move away, well, not a move away, but skills, certain skills from airline pilots have atrophied, have become shrunk or been lost. And we're talking here about the hand flying skills. You know, we've got great pilots coming through the system who, bam, 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 they know how to program an FMS. But suddenly, you say, oh, hang on, you know, just ignore all the systems, land at that aerodrome, you know, visual approach. And some of them are really making heavy going of flying into, what should be, you know, for a GA pilot, at least a really sort of simple visual approach or things like that. So that's what the thing behind it. There's a lot of work going on as do you give them aerobatic training? Do you put increase the envelope of the simulators? Do you give them more ground school? How do you make them aware? Stuff like that. We had a very interesting presentation there by a lady who was a captain at EasyJet. She was a safety officer, but she was also a gliding pilot and a very good competition glider pilot. And she gave a fascinating presentation on, you know, how, you know, the gliding kind of teaches you to be very aware of your angle of attack. You're constantly kind of looking out for weather. You're aware of energy management. And some of these things that you think, well, that doesn't really make much, you know, airliners what's the connection here between a big airliner and a glider?
The principles are exactly the same, aren't they?
The principles exactly the same.
It doesn't matter how big it is, yeah.
And stuff like energy management can help you if you are trying to get into some of these smaller regional airlines that sort of like the low-cost carriers serve, where they haven't got all the kind of runway navigational instruments. You know, maybe they're tucked in inside mountains. And if you've been gliding and you know how to kind of dump your speed and things like that, it's a whole lot easier. So that was a really, really fascinating. And it's cheap as well, you know, really cheap, you know, 10 quid per gliding launch. So really, really sort of fascinating thing. And of course, it's proven by, you know, that one of the most famous sort of glider pilots, come airline pilots, is Sully Sullenberger.
Yeah, of course.
Did his experience coming useful?
Yeah. You also got to hear about Tom Watson, MP. He had some things to say about drones, not all of them complimentary.
Well, yeah, we had another conference there on UAVs and the unmanned aviation. Now, this is a growth area in civil aviation. We already know it about what they do in Afghanistan in supporting ground troops. And he was there to talk about the a UK Parliament group. It's all party parliamentary group on drones. It's actually called drones, which actually annoyed a few people at the conference, because they said, well, why don't you kind of be more technical? You know, you're trying to educate and inform fellow parliamentarians on what drones do. Well, sorry, what UAVs do. So that caused a bit of a heated debate there. So. You know, he did really raise some interesting sort of questions, like, you know, privacy. What about targeted strikes in Afghan and Pakistan? But that's something separate. to what the kind of conference was talking about. And he also sort of was talking about kind of rules of engagement, you know, like, you know, are the rules of engagement the same as for, you know, manned aircraft? Well, an RAF guy went on later on and so said, you know, actually, they're exactly the same. You know, we don't distinguish between the two. And another one which he was saying, well, why don't we publish the rules of engagement for drone strikes? You know, this is the RAF drone strikes. And why can't we publish them? Well, you know, and again, the RAF guy said, well, if you publish them, you know, the enemy's going to take advantage of them, of that. You know, it would be, in my mind, at least, it'd be like a kind of a political party publishing all its rules of engagement or its you know, what its pre-election tactics before the election. You know, the other side is just going to use it to their advantage. So, to his credit, he went there and stuck his head in the lion's den and you know, sort of talked to industry and you know, like I say, very, very lively debate. And you know, now it's really sort of in industry's court to kind of come back to him and sort of say, look, you know, this is you know, this is the true story about this. This, you know, you've got this bit wrong, but you know, we are concerned about this, we are addressing this, and to actually kind of engage them and trying to educate the, you know, the policymakers on, you know, yep, there are challenges here, but you know, there are big opportunities as well.
Okay, I think we'll leave the news there then. After this, we'll hear from Tracy Curtis Taylor, who's recreating the historic flight to fly from Cape Town to the UK in her Stearman.
From across the globe, from the centre of aerospace, and now to you.
The Royal Aeronautical Society has a range of specialist groups which focus on a specific domain or discipline. They form a vital interface between the society and the world at large, and serve both the interests of enthusiasts and professionals through debate, conferences, lectures and other activities. Learn how you can get involved. Visit www.aerosociety.com.
New York Tower, good evening. Aerogal 700 Heavy, approaching to our south 3000.
Aerogal 700 Heavy Kennedy Tower, wind calm, runway 13 left, clear land.
Wind calm, 13 left, clear to land, Aerogal 700 Heavy.
Air France 011 Heavy, contact New York, departure, au revoir.
Departure of France 011 Heavy, au revoir, merci.
JetBlue 43, wind calm, runway 13 right, clear for takeoff. KLM 644 Heavy Kennedy Tower, runway 13 right, position hold.
Position hold, 13 right, KLM 644 Heavy.
KLM 644 Heavy, 13 right, clear for takeoff.
Clear takeoff, 13 right, KLM 644 Heavy.
Blue 43, contact departure.
Contact departure, JetBlue 43.
Blue 1087, Saracosta, Lake Turbulence, 13 right, position hold. KLM 644 Heading 110, contact departure, good night.
Clear departure, bye-bye, KLM 644.
JetBlue 1087, wind light and variable, 13 right, clear for takeoff. On the 122, tower 13 right, position and hold.
Pause and hold, that's the 122. And power for Delta 122. It looks like that guy's trying to land on 13 right.
Aerogal 700 Heavy, go around, fly runway heading, because you're lining up for the wrong runway. You need to start an immediate right turn.
Okay, roger, going around the last 300.
But you need to start an immediate right turn. You need to turn right. There's somebody rolling underneath you.
Roger, heading...
Right, heading 180 for now.
Heading 180, Ross Academy.
On the 122, thank you.
No worries. And for Delta 122, are we still line up and wait, or what do you want?
Yeah, 13 right, position and hold.
All right, we'll give it a shot. Check out the right window, guys.
Blue 1087 has traffic off the right.
Blue 1087, yep, yeah, just fly runway heading for now.
Runway heading 200.
Further right, heading 200.
270, Ross Academy.
No, sir. 200 heading.
200
Aerogal 700 Heavy. Climb and maintain 2000.
Climb and maintain 2700 Heavy.
Lieutenant 87, turn right heading 185.
85, Jeff, Lieutenant 87.
Lieutenant 87, contact departure.
Lieutenant 87.
Aerogal 700, you're climbing through 2400. You can feel free to stop climbing, please.
Roger, 2000 now.
Aerogal 700, call New York, 1257.
1257, Aerogal 700.
Just confirm that heading 185 for JetBlue 1087.
JetBlue 1087, affirmative, heading 185.
JetBlue 1087.
Aerogal 700, sir. Third time, back to 2000, please. On the 122, 13 right, clear for takeoff. JetBlue 1109, caution like turbulence, 13 right, position and hold. Aerogal 700, New York, 1257, please.
I caught up with Tracy on the telephone as she just returned from Hungary. She was moving house and then straight after the interview, racing off to London to meet with her support crew. I first asked her what she was doing in Hungary a few days earlier.
I've just actually returned from Hungary, where I've delivered the aeroplane, the Stearman, which I'll be flying solo across Africa in November. But I've just delivered it back to Hungary, where the team that restored the aeroplane over the last year have just completed a 100-hour check on it. So we're trying to, again, do all the engineering work in this country so that we minimise what we need to do in Africa when we're actually on the expedition. So
yeah.
I flew it back to Hungary from the Goodwood Revival last weekend in, it must be said, filthy conditions across Europe. So it was all great practice. Delivered it back to the team in Hungary, and they've, you know, there was about 12 guys all over it. So two or three of them working on the front end, the engine, and the rest of them just dismantling the whole thing. So the wings have come off, the horizontal stabilizer and the tailplane has all come off. All the fuel system over the wings and the electrics and wiring and heaven knows what. So it was a big job. But that was 2 days, and we loaded it then into the container. It was trucked off through Vienna Customs and onto Hamburg, where it's leaving for Cape Town tomorrow. So.
Right. Well, tell us a little bit about that then, Tracy. You're about to go on what some would describe as a rather unusual journey. Why now and why you?
You know, I think this is the culmination of my whole life. This is my life's endeavour, this flight. I had an early fascination with Africa and was out there in the early 80s, just in fact before I learnt to fly. I then went on to New Zealand and learnt to fly, you know, did a private licence, a commercial licence, and instructed for several years. But more importantly, I got into flying old aeroplanes, vintage aeroplanes with the New Zealand Warbirds. So, you know, this is sort of 25 years ago. So I've predominantly done most of my flying on historic aeroplanes. So this flight, in flying old aeroplanes, you've become, of course, seriously interested in the people who flew them in history. And
yeah.
Particularly for me, that era of, you know, post-World War One, the 1920s and 30s, which was all about record-breaking flights, pioneering aviators, you know, establishing the early air routes and proving that these things could be done in aeroplanes. And of course, Mary Heath, for me, is one of the great heroines of that era. Nobody's heard of her now. I came across the story 4 or 5 years ago, and it's an entrancing story. I mean, she sort of came from total obscurity in rural Ireland, a very, very fractured family background. Her father murdered her mother. She
Gosh.
Was raised by her aunts as effectively an orphan.
Right.
And then goes on to, you know, an extraordinary achiever. You know, she was highly intelligent. She was highly energetic. She became an athletic, an Olympic athlete. So this is an all-rounder. You know, she had wonderful sort of management skills, but she was a born leader.
Yeah.
I think. So in an era when, of course, that's not always recognized or approved, you know, her whole life story is one of struggling against the establishment to try and achieve what she wanted in life, which was to be a commercial pilot.
And she made that epic journey from Cape Town to the UK, and that's what you're going to be creating.
She was the first person to fly the route in 1928 in a light aircraft, and that was coming up what then became the Imperial Airways route up the eastern side of Africa.
Right.
So she set off. You know, she had her plane shipped out there, and I think initially she was just thinking she'd do a few sort of joyrides in the area, because she was a tireless promoter of aviation, and actually some of those far-flung places down the eastern side of Africa are some of the first aero clubs in the world, in the Cape and in Bulawayo in Zimbabwe. So she was going on a sort of tiki tour, and then I think it became a serious project where she thought, right, I can do this flight, and you know, get my name out there. So she was very conscious, I think, of being a record breaker, being a groundbreaker. So it was a deliberate attempt to, you know, really establish herself as the preeminent female aviator in the world at that time.
So let's talk a little bit about the flight that you're going to make then. You're going to be flying over some countries that have let's say, had some troubles, how are you going to be supported in the journey? Who's going to be supporting you, and how's this going to work?
Firstly, it's a solo flight, and I'm flying it in an old aeroplane, so we're flying, you know, 1920s technology up, you know, 21st century Africa. I have with me a chase plane, a support aircraft, which in fact has a film crew on board, because of course we're making a documentary feature film of the flight and about Mary Heath's story. I have engineering support as well, and a logistics manager, so he's managing the crew and, you know, all of the support things that which we'll need up Africa, primarily things like avgas. You know, fuel is it's a rare commodity actually in Africa, amazingly enough. Everything operates on Jet A1, but it's avgas that I need for my piston engine. So we're having to position fuel across Africa at great expense. And of course, being Africa, there's no guarantee actually that it's actually where we need it to be. So we do anticipate some problems with that, but that's just part and parcel.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about the journey itself. When are you planning to set off? Where from? And how long is it going to take?
Right. Well, it's all already in progress, in the sense that the aeroplane is now on its way out there. But the official departure date from Cape Town is the 1st of November. So we've got a big launch from Cape Town with the Foreign Office behind it, and our sponsors are also behind it, Artemis Investments, Boeing, and ExecuJet Global Aviation. So we set off on the 1st, and we're anticipating it's going to take 7 weeks. So the plan is to be back at Goodwood in the UK by the 18th of December. It basically takes us up the sort of central and eastern side. So from South Africa, you know, on from Cape Town, up the Garden Route, Durban, up to Johannesburg, Botswana, Zimbabwe, Zambia, Tanzania, Kenya, Uganda, South Sudan, Egypt. And if we're really lucky, once I hit that Mediterranean coast, I'll just be able to turn west and come along through Libya and Tunisia. But there is a slight question mark about Libya, to be honest.
So
to just go directly over the Med to Crete and come up via Athens that way. So, you know, we'll just have to make that call at the time.
Right,
okay. The security situations, we find it.
Yeah. And, of course, the aircraft you're flying is the beautiful Stearman. And I've seen some pictures of it and are very excited about seeing it in person. What's its capabilities? It's open cockpit. You're going to fly a very, very long way. How's the aircraft going to perform over this time?
Well, look, it's a dream machine. It's been restored over the last year, and although it's absolutely standard, so this is a sort of 1930s style biplane, but it's a big biplane and it's a very strong biplane, which is in fact why I wanted to do it in this rather than a de Havilland Moth type, which is perhaps more typical of the period in Africa. But I'm a great exponent of American aeroplanes and radial engines, and the engine that I've had put in this, which is the Lycoming 680, 300 horsepower, is one of the most reliable radial engines ever built. So it's just going to give me a little bit of extra power for hot, high-density altitudes in Africa, you know, a bit more performance on takeoff, etc. So, you know, and getting to good altitude, to be honest, over certain areas.
What sort of heights will you be flying at, Tracy?
Well, to be honest, as low as possible. I think, you know, the idea of doing a flight of this nature up Africa is that you're on the deck. You know, you're flying over the elephants. We're going up the elephant corridor in the, you know, through Tanzania and Kenya. You know, so you want to see it. You want to be there. You know, it's like the flight in Out of Africa. That's what I see in my mind's eye, and that's how I want to fly it. But procedurally and politically, in certain areas, we will have to be a lot higher than say, 1,000 or 1,500 feet. You'll have to be up over 5,000 feet, crossing border areas. You know, in North Africa, though, the security becomes an issue.
Yeah.
So, you know, the advice is just get high and overfly.
And what sort of flying challenges do you think this will place on you? You've got an amazing background in terms of qualifications and flying experience. What do you think the real flying challenges will be for you on this?
Well, I have to say, I've never done anything of this nature, although, you know, as a bit of preparation, I was invited to help crew an Antonov 2 down the western side of Africa. So, but that's a, you know, it's a bit of a different bag. It's a much bigger aeroplane, and it's a sealed cockpit with, you know, with a crew on board. So this is, by the nature of it, is entirely different. You know, I'm on my own. It's open cockpit. You're exposed to the elements. I've got a fuel range of, I don't know, 4.5, 5 hours, depending on power settings.
Yeah.
And yes, distances and the lack of alternate airfields is an issue. If you have mechanical problems, you know, we're going to have to look very, very carefully at the route we go. And of course, the weather is perhaps always one biggest concern in flying anything.
Yeah.
You know, this is not an instrument flight. I have a basic VFR cockpit in the aeroplane. I do have a Garmin 430, so I've got basic navigational aid with that. But, you know, I'm flight planning it really with a map and a ruler. You know, that's how I was trained in World War II navigation.
So yes.
That will still apply. You know, I like getting maps out and physically looking at the route. But so, yeah, no, it's all a challenge. I think just the time in the air, the distances, it's a hostile environment if anything goes wrong or you have to land the aeroplane for whatever reason. Politically, there are huge issues in doing something of this nature, which, you know, people say to me, oh, you know, what was Mary Heath dealing with back in the 1920s? Well, in some respects, it was a lot easier back then. You know, her aeroplane just operated on motor fuel, so she could just go almost anywhere and throw some gas into it and then crack on. But she certainly wasn't confined by border crossings and overflight permissions and political regimes. She had a few issues, funny enough, going through the Sudan. She wasn't allowed to fly on her own with that. She had to have an escort plane going with her.
Right, okay.
So, you know, there's some parallels here, but it's a lot more complicated nowadays because of the bureaucracy.
Just coming back to some of that flying, being in that cockpit on your own for that amount of time, you've got a Garmin and you're going to have some maps. What is it that I suppose you're really looking forward to seeing from the air as you travel on that amazing journey?
Well, I think, you know, to be setting off from Cape Town with, you know, Table Mountain behind me and just the whole of Africa laid out, it is the most spectacular continent, whether you're flying across the Sahara Desert or up classical Africa over savannas and, you know, Kilimanjaro, Mount Kenya. You know, it's an epic landscape.
Yeah.
You know, I fly because I love looking at the Earth. So there's this wonderful sort of relationship between Earth and air, if you like, Earth and space. So I'm sort of somewhere in between in my biplane.
And it just sounds so exciting. Is there any way that we can follow your progress during the flight?
Well, look, indeed, we've got all sorts of live links. The plan is to try and do sort of satellite, you know, streaming as we go up Africa, if we can. But yeah, I'll be sort of blogging twice a week, but it's all run through the website, which is capetowntogoodwood.com.
Okay. And what's the plan when you actually arrive in Goodwood?
Oh, do you know, Peter, I think a very large drink.
sounds like you need one now.
After Christmas, the plan is to have a big party and just, you know, just celebrate, I think, making it. You know, but I can't even allow myself to think that far ahead. We've got the whole thing to do first.
Yeah, and you're very busy. I know you in between all of these arrangements, and we're only weeks away from you leaving. You're moving house as well, so we really appreciate you coming onto the show. In terms of, you mentioned some of your supporters. How are you being supported by those organisations? You mentioned Artemis and Boeing.
I have basically three sponsors. Boeing came on board as my first sponsor because, of course, it is a Boeing Stearman.
Yeah.
And, you know, they're probably the biggest name in international aerospace. Everyone, but you tend to think everybody knows what a Boeing 747 is, but not that many people appreciate that this is a Boeing Stearman. It goes right back to Boeing heritage, and they're coming up to 100 years of history. So I was talking at the Royal International Air Tattoo a year ago to, you know, some of the people from Boeing military, and I just said, you know, this, you guys should be all over this project.
Yeah.
You know, it's just an epic. It's so rare for a recreation of a flight like this. It's just so rare for these things to happen, and the fact that, you know, it's a Boeing Stearman, it's me doing it, you know. And they did. They came in as my first sponsor, which psychologically is a huge shot in the arm.
Yeah, fantastic, fantastic.
And then, of course, the flagship sponsor is Artemis Investments. And funny enough, I'd seen their advertisement over a year before I approached them, and they featured a sort of 1930s flying boat, and it looked a bit like it was in the Pacific, flying over a tropical island. And there's a kind of visual pun here, because they're looking for the profit. But the way the advertisement was couched, it was all about, you know, we're in this for range and endurance, and we're off the beaten track. And, of course, you know, it featured this lovely silver aeroplane. Bingo. Somebody there likes old aeroplanes and has a view of adventure, and you know, and a romantic view of adventure. So I ended up just writing to the chief executive and told him that. I just said, look, I'm doing this ridiculous flight up Africa, but actually it embodies everything that you're trying to convey in your advertisement.
Yeah, yeah.
And he sponsored me, and 3 days later that they came on board. And, you know,
wonderful.
It was, in fact, the turning point for the project, because I don't think we could have done it without that. I mean, I could have done it, but very, very pared down.
Yeah, sure,
what
sure.
What it's enabled us to do is have a bigger support aircraft. It's covered all the core expedition costs. And they've been just magnificent to deal with. So I couldn't be happier.
It's amazing. And the reason I asked you that question is because it's so important to keep a lot of these aircraft going and to keep the memories of flights like Mary's in all of our minds as we move into, you know, the space age and all the exciting stuff. We shouldn't ever forget the aviation history that we have. So it's great they've come on board.
That's quite right. We have an astonishing heritage in this country. So it really is a celebration of that. And in fact, it's one of the reasons that Downing Street, with their Britain is Great campaign, have also been very, very supportive of the project. They just, again, they're trying to focus on women in these sorts of technical engineering areas, and also celebrating this history. So they've also come on board and been massively supportive of the project, which is why I have, you know, the Union Jack slapped down the side of the aeroplane, and we're being supported by the Foreign Office up Africa as we go.
Well, that's absolutely wonderful news. It's such an exciting journey. We're looking forward to tracking your progress and hopefully getting to see you in time for Christmas.
Touch wood, Peter. Well, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Oh, thanks very much for joining us.
Okay, bye.
Just think it's a great sort of adventure, isn't it? You know, and I like the fact she's chosen the Boeing Stearman because it's sturdy.
Yeah,
sturdier than the Tiger Morph. So sturdier than the de Havilland planes, which are, yeah, okay. But, you know, what a great thing. And, you know, you asked her how high are you going to fly. Well, as low as possible, of course. You want to see all the stuff that's going on. So you know, best of British to her.
Yeah.
It's great that you see us support it. And there's going to be from the sound of it, it's going to be like a film or a TV documentary about it or something.
Yeah, like, that's right.
Be fantastic.
Yeah, they're gonna film as much as they can. And I think she also does a great deal to support the involvement of female pilots in the industry. So I think it's hopefully focused on encouraging people into the industry, particularly girls. So a great shout for those guys, and we're going to track their progress and see if we can get her back on the show once she's settled back after Christmas. But a lovely lady, got a lot of cojones, shall we say, to do something like that. Certainly exciting stuff, and it was great to have Tracy with us.
Area 6124, have you appeared smoke on your nose wheel?
Area 6124, heavy. We are gonna take off. We're gonna leave the runway on the right.
Area 6124, heavy rider, that ma'am, turn right, and do you require any assistance?
Negative, we don't require any assistance, thank you.
6124, heavy rider, ma'am, and did you want to taxi back to the gate or taxi back to the runway?
No, we're going to go back to the runway, Area 6124.
6124, heavy rider. Cancel your takeoff clearance. You can turn right onto taxi way, Mike, then hold short on my 8 right.
Okay, Area 6124. We're going to take Mike again and go back to the holding position.
Listed in the Sunday Times top 10 geeky holiday spots on the planet, no other single location in the world has contributed so much to the development of aeronautical science over such a long period of time, and that is, of course, Farnborough.
The aircraft we do have all have our XREE experimental aircraft. So the Jaguar we have did an enormous amount of work on head-up displays. The Hunter we have did all the low-level FLIR work. The Puma we have was an experimental Puma, structural experimental flying Puma here. And the Nat was a structural test aircraft. The Harrier T2 we've got was a EMC, electromagnetic compatibility aircraft.
You can see all of these at the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum. And the greatest thing about the Farnborough Air Sciences Trust Museum is it's free. Go and visit them at airsciences.org.uk to find out more. And if you can get to the south of England, you shouldn't miss this.
Things you never knew about.
Things you never knew about. This episode comes from my interest in runway headings. Runway headings become familiar to us when we see the first two digits displayed at each end of the runway painted in large white numbers. These numbers refer to the direction the runway is facing, and within a 5-degree difference, either side will be rounded up. So a runway facing north would be 36 or 360 degrees. Nothing new there, really. We pretty much all had an inkling about that. So why do we use magnetic headings on runways rather than true north? Well, because historically, runways have been built to face into the prevailing winds. And this is because takeoff and landing, of course, in an aircraft is normally and most safely into the wind, allowing maximum lift over the wings. Again, nothing really new there. But what made me think a little bit more about this is when I was younger, Heathrow had runways 10 and 28 and now has runways 9 and 27. But the runways haven't moved. But what has moved, and the reason that Brussels Airport last month had to make a change, is that the Earth's magnetic north is constantly shifting. In fact, it's moving closer towards Russia at this very point. Scientists don't even know why. Anyway, I went to Brussels Airport website and I read the following. The magnetic north of our planet shifts a bit each year, so that at a certain moment, 11 degrees becomes 10 degrees, and a few years later, even 9 degrees. So eventually, some airports find themselves with a runway whose name that was given years ago no longer matches today's reality on the compass. These annual changes are small, but Brussels Airport has now reached a point where 0220 needs to be renamed 0119. The official name change will happen on the night of the 18th and 19th of September, which has just gone, of course. But putting a runway name change into force requires more than just painting a new number on both sides of the runway. The fact is that the name of a runway appears on hundreds, if not thousands, of official documents and on plans, and they all have to be updated. So during that night, a month or so ago, the name was changed and all the databases used for aeronautical navigation all across the world had to be changed, all at the same time, so that Brussels Airport was reflected across the world. So, to avoid any misunderstanding, the runway is 0119. It'll be exactly the same runway as the new runway 0220. It will only wear a new number painted at both ends. And that was from Brussels Airport. So there you go. Things you never knew about.
I didn't know any of that, by the way.
That's really
quite interesting.
I'm sure it's the scam by the aeronautical chart makers.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you know what?
you're gonna have to move that one.
Yeah.
I never knew why Heathrow had changed its numbers all those years ago. I sort of had a bit of an inkling, but what I didn't know is about magnetic north, and that is a bit naughty because I did learn that when I was doing my flying training. So yeah, there you go.
Things you never knew about.
Find this and other great shows at the Aviation Media Network.
TheVoicesInYourHead.com.
Okay, 29 Quebec, I do see you in the base, and if you could just bring it back to the field, I do have traffic to follow you.
Could
Roger. Repeat that brain back to where?
This is 29 to Quebec. Point the nose of your airplane right at the airport, please. 29, you're clear to land.
Turn you right now. Clear to land on runway 29 for 29 Quebec.
Extended. It's time to talk aviation. Email us now. Get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk. And remember, there's no E at the beginning of extended. Aviation questions, suggested topics, or even good old feedback are all welcome.
And so to the get involved and feedback section of the show. A round of thanks to Captain Jeff Nielsen, and he's the host of the Airline Pilot Guide podcast, who very graciously mentioned us on his show recently, saying this was an excellent aviation podcast. So thanks, Jeff. And for anyone who hasn't listened to his show, it's a great show. He talks about aviation from a pilot's perspective. He is an American airline captain, so he predominantly talks about that sector, but it's a really great listen. Moving on, we also got a mention on the Glider podcast. Sam Deeks, a guest on the show on our last episode, gave us a big shout out. So thank you very much, Sam. Over to emails then. First email came from Roger Preston. I enjoy the extended show. It gives me time to explore the subjects better. And he listens when he's on a journey on the tube or flying. He was looking for a link to a book we mentioned, so we've sent that on to him. We also received an email from Paul Filmer. Many of you know Paul as Skippy Cage. I think Gareth knows him very well. He did, in fact, catch us out, or he certainly took us to task by saying that you never saw the 146 as a fire tanker. They already flew a full season last year. And he highlighted the fact that Global Aviation Resource reported on this story back in April 2009. He did ask me to admonish Gareth, but I think you're suitably admonished.
I'm hanging my head in shame.
Now, I've got to say that Paul, or Skippy Cage, as he's known in a lot of social media areas, is a superb photographer, and he particularly has the capability to photograph things in unusual places and unusual airlines, air forces, and aircraft types. So if you're not following him on Facebook or Twitter or on his webpage, you should do. And we might even ask Paul, maybe if he'll come on the show one time and talk to us about his photography. So
we should. We've published lots of pieces from Skippy on his trips to, you know, Siberia and various sort of remote outposts in Russia and such like, and he's been to some fascinating places.
He could probably write the next 25 things you never knew about segments from some of his trips, I'm sure. Anyway, over to Twitter. In response to Tim's question in the last episode, which was, can you tell us what aircraft types have fought each other? Sam Deeks actually tweeted us back and said the Spitfire versus Spitfire Israel 1948. So
that's right, yeah.
He was right, wasn't he, Tim?
That was a Spitfire versus Spitfire versus Spitfire, because it was Israeli versus RAF versus Egyptian Spitfires at one point.
Wow.
Yeah.
It was a mix up and a bit of a blue on blue on blue. Well, blue on, I don't know, you know, a very, very odd part of aviation history.
Yeah. And Private Joker 8, in response to Amy's challenge, said, evening chaps, just a wee tweet to say I thoroughly enjoyed the latest podcast. As for Amy's challenge, I'd like to say the B-52, although not overly scary looking, seeing her from the enemy's perspective with her capability would be terrifying. So that was, of course, Amy's challenge in our last show. We have another one, which is coming up very soon. over onto Facebook. We posted a YouTube link to a video of a model Concorde that was powered by small turbines flying in yes, in response to Neil Graham's question in the last episode as to whether we thought Concorde would fly again. We all, of course, said no, it wouldn't. But if you go and see that video, you can go over to our Facebook page. You'll see what we mean when we said we got that one wrong. Quite an impressive video, that.
You've got to have some room to keep a model like that, haven't you? You almost need a hangar.
It's ginormous, isn't it?
It's huge.
It's just unbelievable. It really, really is.
I've seen a model B-17, right, which is so big, the pilot actually sits in it. It's not a model aircraft. It's kind of weird. I'll have to find a link to that. But it's basically a model aircraft that a pilot could sit in.
Wow.
Four engines, scaled, perfectly scaled. You know.
Wow.
Neil did come back and said, laugh out loud, not quite the same as I remember when it flew over my house and school around 11 a.m. And sadly, it will have to do for now. So, yeah, unfortunately it will. But it really is an impressive video. So do go and have a look at that link on our Facebook page. And so over to Amy's challenge for this episode.
Hi, Peter, Gareth and Tim, it's Amy. I got a tweet this morning asking if I'd done an Amy's challenge for this episode, and I realised that I hadn't. It's a bit of a weird question, actually. It's about music. I had a conversation with a friend last week, and we were just sharing music, saying, oh, I like this song, sort of thing, and we ended up getting talking about Air Displays and realising that half of the songs that we like and what we listen to would actually go really well with Air Displays. But I just wondered what you guys thought would be the perfect song for a good Air Display, because personally I feel that Top Gun songs such as Top Gun Anthem or Danger Zone are getting too frequently used, and personally I don't think it fits with most Air Displays, such as, I don't know, Red Arrows getting used. That music, I don't like it, so I figured that maybe our show organisers need to change it up a bit. So my question to you guys this week is, if you could choose the perfect song for an Air Display, what would it be? Keep up the good work as always, and I can't wait to listen to the episode. And I'm really looking forward to being on the show at Christmas, so see you later, guys.
Okay, guys, so if you could choose a track that could be played at an air show, I've got a couple. I'll go first. I've got Back in Black by AC/DC. Ooh. From the Highway to Hell album. I couldn't, when she posed this and I listened, I couldn't but not think of Jamie Norris tearing up the sky.
Yeah.
And so all that went through my head were was heavy metal, to be honest. And the only other one that I came up with was Holiday by Green Day on the American Idiot album.
Not Madonna, no,
I don't think so. for those who know the tracks, but of course it is all about war, that track, and I certainly would make a good track back into a P-51 Mustang or something like that, tearing up the Duxford skies, I think.
Okay, I'll go next then. Like you, I went for rock. What I particularly thought, look for, would be good would be, if you've seen the film Iron Eagle, you'll know One Vision goes perfectly with F-16s.
All right.
That needs to be done. And I thought that an A-10 display would be perfect for Queen's Hammer to Fall.
Yeah.
And the final thing I thought would be quite good would be getting a UH-1 Huey display to a bit of sort of 60s rock, you know, Fortunate Son. So that sort of stuff.
Okay, what about you then, Gareth?
Well, listen, that was all very good, chaps, but it's all a little bit predictable, isn't it? With you with your rock music, the two of you and such like. I've got two as well, and they are about as far away from being rock as you could probably get. I like there's two things that I like. I like classical music, and I like kind of big, bombastic dance music as well. And what I like even more than those two things is when the two things come together. And there's a little bit of that with one of my choices, which is a track called And I Will Kiss, which is by Underworld. And I think a few people are hopefully nodding their heads at this point because it was part of the Olympic opening ceremony in 2012 and was pretty incredible. The other one by a big dance producer and writer, a guy called Rob Duggan, but it's an entirely classical song called Will You Follow Me, but it's incredibly uplifting and I've always thought would be absolutely brilliant at an air show for probably Warbird, like maybe display team, something like that.
Hello, Charles 11-9. I got a question for you.
Go ahead, sir.
That big tower back at my 8 o'clock, has it been there for a while?
8 o'clock now, sir, or is it back behind you?
Yeah, well, I'm moving to 7 o'clock now.
Yeah, it's the Mount Aluminum, and that tower is probably some kind of microwave or tower, but it's been there. Who knows what they put up these days? It's within 200 feet of the surface there.
Yeah, just never noticed.
MVA just off your left side there, about 3 miles off your left side, is 5,100 feet, and it starts tapered into the valley we're at now.
Okay.
1190, contact Sunday Tower 124.0. They may give you the right runway if you ask them.
Alright, so 1190, good night.
Good night, sir.
Then, finally, before we go, promoting aerospace. Tim, do you have an aerospace topic?
Yeah, I've got one. Actually, I've just thought of another one as well. So if I can.
Yeah, you can take mine.
To take mine. Okay, first of all, astronaut Jim Lovell, Captain Jim Lovell of Apollo 13 fame. He's going to be honoured with a Guild of Air Pilots and Air Navigators Award.
Wow.
Later this month, 23rd of October in London, at their annual trophies and awards banquet. He's going to get the Award of Honour at London's Medieval Guild Hall. So that is well-deserved recognition for his sort of services to aviation and aerospace.
Yeah.
Can't get much sort of higher than that, really. My second promoting aerospace one is a little plug for our own Aero Pub Quiz for AvGeeks. So if you're an AvGeek in the UK, if you're an AvGeek outside the UK, the Aero Pub Quiz is back. Monday, 25th of November, get in, get a team. The winning team of last year was a team dominated by Qantas A380 pilots. I don't know whether they're coming back to defend their honour, but get a team together. It's going to be a great night. A few sort of drinks and having a laugh with friends and colleagues, and showing off your aero knowledge.
And whereabouts is that, Tim? In London?
That's going to be at the Society's HQ in London, 25th of right. November.
Gareth, have you got anything that you'd like to promote?
I wasn't very well last year, so I definitely need to try and make it down for the pub quiz this year. And also, brilliant to think that Jim Lovell is finally going to pick up a GAPAN award, something that Global Aviation Resource picked up a couple of years ago. But anyway, this is a fantastic little story that and a website I want to point you towards. And it's actually something that we published on Global Aviation Resource, in which I, hands up, I knew nothing about until Elliot put it together. 1st of March next year is the 100th anniversary of the first military flight in Australia. And back in 2006, a couple of engineers, retired engineers, decided they would build an airworthy replica, obviously, of a Bristol box kite, which they would like to present to the Royal Australian Air Force Museum. And it was the box kite that made that first military flight in Australia 100 years ago. Well, 100 years ago, next year. Last month, that replica flew for the first time, and it's absolutely extraordinary. What an incredible, incredible feat. I love it when anniversaries are, you know, big anniversaries are marked with something like, you know, as incredible as that, to think that these two guys have basically just decided to go ahead and do it. It was flown by a guy called Air Vice Marshal Mark Skidmore, who's a former F-111 pilot and was a test pilot. And there's a brilliant quote in Elliot's piece saying that from Air Vice Marshal, saying, "I now have the honour of being the only Royal Australian Air Force pilot who's flown both the fastest and slowest aircraft in the Australian Air Force." It's absolutely stunning. And if you go to boxkite2014.org, you can see it all there for yourself. And we'll put some links on there. But what a brilliant achievement. And I'm looking forward to seeing how the anniversary is marked out in Australia next year.
They do some great stuff down there, don't they? I mean, they're the other end of the world, and they've got kind of box kite, mosquito. They've got, Sir Peter Jackson's kind of World War One Air Force.
Yeah. We don't do badly over here, do we? But they've got some real sort of mouth-watering stuff going on down there. Fair play.
Okay, it's time to wrap up for this episode. We'd like to thank Tracy Curtis-Taylor for her time in talking to us prior to her historic flight, and to Skyrocket Cafe for supporting Extended. We'd also like to thank White Hearts, Peter Dixon, and liveatc.net for their contributions. Show notes for this episode with the accompanying pictures and links for the topics can be found on our website, which of course is aviation-extended.co.uk, and also on our Facebook page. You can follow us on Twitter as Aviation Extended. So, Gareth, where can we find you online?
Yeah, as ever, Global Aviation Resources at globalaviationresource.com, and you can find me on Twitter at Gareth_Stringer.
And Tim?
Yeah, you can find the Aeronautical Society's website at aerosociety.com, and I'm on Twitter at RESTimR.
And you can find me, Peter Johnson, at Nascot Hornet on Twitter and at xtpmedia.co.uk, as well as on Facebook at xtpmedia. Our legal policy and use of our material can be found on our website, and please do ask before using anything you hear. And with the arrival of the music, it's goodbye from Gareth Stringer.
Goodbye.
And it's goodbye from Tim Robinson.
Goodbye, everybody. Thanks for joining us. See you next time.
And it's goodbye from me, Peter Johnson. Thank you very much for joining us again, and I hope you enjoyed the programme. And remember to stay tuned into this frequency, Extended, Europe's premier aerospace radio programme.
Extended would like to thank its partners, Global Aviation Resource, the Royal Aeronautical Society, and XTP Media, for their support in helping to present and produce the programme. Thanks for listening to Extended. We'll see you next time. And don't forget, we want you to contact us. So get involved at aviation-extended.co.uk is the email address you need.
Where did T6 come from?
Beechcraft.
Yes. just in terms of it being the T6.
O'Leary's saying that Ryanair's going to kind of be nice to customers. That's quite a funny one.
Yeah. I'll be honest with you, Tim. I saw some of that stuff and just be a bit of a numpty, but I didn't understand it.
Well, there you go. And it just went downhill from there.
Okay. Yeah.
Double-edged sword on that one. I cocked up on both fronts there, clearly.
Okay, right, okay. So, all right, she's obviously got ideas of, I don't know, what, dance music or Classical? Jazz? Alright, we'll have to have a think about this.
So is space next? And then it's Christmas.
No, we've got another one in between that, I'm afraid. Well, I'm glad someone learned something from one of our things you never knew about. Right.
My music collection is with my phone at the moment.
Right.
Down the drain. Freak accident. Is this an outtake on the?
It could be about to become one.
A freak accident, hop, skip, and jump, and my mobile phone slipped out of my hands on Friday and went down a storm drain.
No.
There was a plop and a splosh and lost forever. Yes. So I'm in the digital stone age at the moment. I've no idea what's happening.
I always say this now. I don't think there's many outtakes, but I always end up with 3 or 4 minutes. No, I don't think there's too much there. I'll
extend it.
This is XTP Media.